Well, good morning, Eastleigh Baptist Church and friends. Welcome, Sunshine. Welcome, Swathling folk. Thank you to Ricky and to Tom and to Girls Brigade and to Lou Fellingham for that wonderful song. Thank you to Jessica and Alan for that reading from Job chapter 2 and 3 as well. My own hi to you, Ray. Take it on easy on that Bovril, brother. This is the second instalment in our series on the book of Job. You'll find the book of Job just before the book of Psalms in your Bible, almost in the very middle of your Bible. To recap on our series here, this man Job, a good man, a righteous man, a family man, has just had his world fall apart, or rather has had his world blown apart. All of his sons and daughters are killed, and his wealth and possessions taken as plunder. If that wasn't bad enough, and let's face it, that is bad, he's also been afflicted with a hideous and painful disease that leaves him in constant torment, and he is so disfigured by it as to be almost unrecognizable. By any stretch, this is a grim situation. Then we're told in verse 11 that when Job's three pals hear about his plight, they come to sympathise with him and comfort him. And for the first part of my talk this morning, I want to look at this response of his friends. So at this point, one is thinking, these are really good friends. It's a bit like those guys that carried the paralysed man to Jesus. Because upon hearing of his trouble, they get up and travel to him. How many times are you tempted to head in the opposite direction when you hear of someone's troubles? Bear in mind that any sort of travel in those days was risky. We see in the text that bands of Sabaeans and Chaldeans are roaming around. There was no such thing as a police force in those days. Bear in mind also that travel was uncomfortable. Camel or horse riding might look easy, but have you ever done any of it? 5 minutes was in the saddle was all that I could handle. I just didn't know where to put myself to get comfortable. They didn't have gel padded shorts in those days. But no, despite the risk and despite the discomfort, his friends travel to see Job in his distress. By agreement, they meet together beforehand. In our days, case conferences are considered to be the best way to try and work out how to deal with complicated situations, and it seems this was their wisdom too. His friends determined that they were going to sympathise and comfort, recognising that when someone is down, what is most helpful is not to kick them, but simply to get down alongside them. Not to pontificate or judge or chastise, but just to be there. Verse 12, when they see the state of Job, their hearts go out to him. And there is a clear demonstration of love for him in his distress at his condition. They wept aloud. They tore their robes and put dust on their heads. If that sounds a bit strange to us, a bit over the top maybe, we have to understand the cultural context. That is how people responded to grief, how they expressed grief in that time and at that place. Then most impressively of all, to my mind, they sat with him for 7 days and seven nights. Not in the luxury of Job's pad, but on the ash heap. That's the city's garbage area. Sitting with someone in distress for 7 hours would be a major effort. 7 days and seven nights, that is nothing less than exemplary care. This is impressive friendship. However, from the title of the message today, with friends like these, you will have no doubt picked up the inference that somehow it's going to go rapidly downhill from here. To finish the phrase, with friends like this, who needs enemies? So what on earth do they do? What on earth goes so wrong? Basically, Job opens his mouth. Until he opens his mouth, it seems they're fine. They're there with him. But as soon as he opens it, his mouth, they cannot stop themselves from making some whopping assumptions and highbrow judgments about his predicament. I'm not going to go into their speeches and the theology that ensues, because that is for the following sermons in these series. But suffice to say, the wonderfully heartfelt and empathetic start that they made in going to Job and sitting with him goes right out the window. And they do, in fact, give him a thorough verbal kicking while he was down. In fact, for 30 plus chapters. Of course, if they hadn't done, we wouldn't have the book of Job. And so we and countless generations that have gone before us have benefited from their mistake or their wrongdoing. But for Job at the time, this was not what he needed to hear. Welcome to Job's three friends. Secondly, let's turn to our main character, Job himself. You've heard this morning Alan read his lament. I'm not going to reread it, but I will just pull out a few words, key words or phrases, which will remind you of its flavour. Perish. Darkness. Blot it out. Barren. Curse. Bitter. Long for death, turmoil, groans, and numerous whys. What comes out when Job opens his mouth is not pretty. It's a howl. It's a wail. That is what emotional pain sounds like. I wonder, what is your reaction to this? Is it, I can't imagine how difficult, how painful that must have been for you, Job? Or is it, you can't talk to God like that? Or is it, get a grip, man? Or is it, I can't listen to this. This is too stressful. Get me out of here. But of course, this isn't just Job, is it? Job's situation is extreme, but we experience or witness trauma in our own lives or in the lives of those that are close to us as well, don't we? And how we respond to each other's trauma or grief or despair or raw pain is so important if we're going to be genuine help to people in their distress and be true friends and true family to each other. As a book called Breakthrough, The Art of Surviving put it, we need to become trauma aware. If people are to survive trauma, they need authentic community. A trauma-informed church has to, above all, become a safe space for survivors, because without safety, the grieving and the traumatized will not stick around, let alone be able to grow and heal. Safety means a great deal more than simply keeping people physically safe. It means keeping them emotionally and spiritually safe, and that means free to vent, even rage, without judgment. Survivors of trauma are all too often left metaphorically naked and bleeding by the side of the Jericho road. Go and check out the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. Those of us who follow and love Jesus have the resources to help them, at least to some degree, but too often in our Britishness, in our discomfort at raw expressions of emotion, in our fear of saying the wrong thing, of getting sucked in too deep, of somehow being too tolerant or lenient, we behave like the priest or the Levite and cross to the other side, leave it for someone else to sort out the mess. As one of the commentary authors put it rather caustically, our prescription for the afflicted is torpid resignation to the unquestionable will of God, a strict curb on all feelings, or at least on the outward expression of them, with disapproval of the weakling majority who cannot walk calmly into the furnace without tranquility undisturbed. Ouch. I had such a difficult journey with Costi in this regard. For those of you who don't know him or didn't know him, Costi was a 35-year-old Romanian who came to us trying to turn his back on a wayward past and who then got diagnosed with terminal cancer. And how he railed and how he howled. How could God allow this to happen to him, especially when he had given his life to God, given himself to trying to do good and change? Remembering that time, I so wanted Costi to see his suffering as his big moment, his time to be his heroic, his time to take his diagnosis on the chin and to flourish despite it. A bit like Betsy in that extract that Ricky read to us, somehow seeing the goodness in that ghastly situation. But for Costi, his sense of injustice was what reigned. The heat of his anger, the toxicity of his bitterness shocked me and on numerous occasions just made me recoil as I struggled to stay with him. And I found it so hard to know what to say, what to do, when was the right time to say and do whatever. And that is the biggest problem, isn't it? That is when we're confronted by someone in emotional pain, that difficulty of knowing what to say, what to do. At this point, I'm going to hand over to a very dear friend, Emma, who is going to take us through a terrible tragedy that she and her family had to go through and what helped her and them in that situation.
Toby, most of you will know my family, but for the benefit of those of you who don't, here's a little picture of us all. At the back is my husband, Robert. We've been married for 24 years. At the front and in the middle, that is our oldest daughter, Beth. She's 17. On the right is Imogen. She is 12. And on the left is Harry, and he's just had his 11th birthday. The observant amongst you will have noticed that we have a 5-year age gap between Beth and Emma. The reason for this gap is that we have another daughter. She's called Abby. Abby was born in June 2005. Here's a little picture of her a few weeks after I gave birth to her. Abby was a very content baby. She was a great sleeper, and as you can see from the picture, was a thumb sucker. She loved Rice Krispies and hated bananas. This is a picture of Abby on her first birthday. You can see she very much enjoyed chocolate cake too. She loved playing with her big sister Beth, who took excellent care of her even though she was just little herself. And this is one of our favourite pictures of the two girls together. We had been making pasta necklaces that day and the girls were proudly showing off what they had made. After giving birth to Abby and when my maternity leave was over, I went back to work as in my job as an actuary. But then after a few months, I was fortunate enough to be able to give up work and be a full-time at-home mum to our two girls. Family life was hectic, as it is for everyone with small children, but it was really good. Then one Saturday in October 2006, our world changed forever. Abby woke up that morning with what looked like a tummy bug. And by late afternoon, however, it was clear that it was much more serious than that, and I called an ambulance. The A&E team who looked after her when we arrived realised that she was seriously ill, and a large team started working on her while Robert and I watched on. Just after 7:20 p.m. on that Saturday evening, however, despite the heroic efforts of the doctors, Abby died. Later, we were to find out that she died from pneumococcal septicemia, and had only been a few weeks away from having a vaccination that would have saved her life. In the space of just 12 hours, every parent's worst nightmare had come true for us. And we find ourselves right in the middle of a storm of pain and shock at what had just happened. This morning, we are in the second of our sermon series in Job. The pain of Abby's death was and still is massive, and I can't therefore even imagine what Job's pain was like over everything that he had lost that we read about in chapters 1 and 2. Today, Toby is looking at Job's friends and what kind of job they did in supporting him through the storm he found himself in. So I wanted to tell you about some of the friends we had at the time of Abby's death. Much of the time at the hospital on that Saturday evening is a blur. There are a few things, however, I do remember clearly. And one of these is that in the midst of the doctors trying to treat Abby, Martin and Jan Poole turned up. For those of you who don't know Martin and Jan, Martin was our senior minister before Joth. I don't know how they knew what was going on that evening, but they just arrived at the hospital. They sat on the other side of the doors of the room that Abby was being treated in with Robert and I watching on, and were praying for us. At one point, the doctors took us out of the room to explain what was going on, and then Martin and Jan joined us and prayed with us in that moment. Those moments of connection with them and knowing that they were there were so comforting amidst the chaos of what was occurring around us that evening. We hadn't asked them to come into that traumatic situation, but they did it anyway, as they sensed it was the right thing to do, and it was. Once Abby's Thanksgiving service was over, we had to try and return to some kind of normal life. Robert had to go back to work, and I then found myself with a lot of time on my hands. Only a few weeks ago, I was mum to two girls, but no longer had one with me. Beth was at preschool a number of mornings a week, so I was often home alone. Those of you who have travelled through a period of grief will know that one of the hardest moments in that journey is immediately after the Thanksgiving service or funeral, and for some months afterwards as you try and adjust, and it was no different for us. Both of our families live quite far away, so although they were with us immediately after Abby died, they too had to go home and get on with their lives. It was during this time that Jan came and sat with me, cried with me, gave me opportunity to talk about Abby, prayed with me, and listened as I wrestled with the unfairness of it all. I'm very grateful for all that she did and for Martin's regular check-ins with Robert. I'm also very grateful for my small group at the time. I was part of Tuesday group, and many of us in that group at that time had preschool age children, and that group of ladies, you know who you are, were brilliant too. In order to be brilliant, they didn't have to do anything amazing. However, what they did was much the same as Jan. They encouraged me out of the house. They gave me opportunities to talk about Abby. They offered to look after Beth or give her opportunities to play with their children, as she was so desperately missing Abby at home to play with. They prayed with me and for us all. That's what we hope all of our small groups would do for each other when a storm hits, and they really did. So the secret of being a good friend to me in that time was to be present in that moment of crisis and to be present afterwards, to talk about Abby, to do some practical stuff I just didn't have the energy for, cooking and cleaning, playing with Beth, for instance, and to listen to me, ask all the why questions, and to get angry, to cry with me, and to pray for us and with us. We didn't need someone to come and try to help us find an intellectual reason for why Abby had died. We knew there wasn't one. We just needed someone to be there to walk through it with us. If Abby was still here, she would have been 15 in June, and we miss her every day. I was very angry with God for some time. Why didn't he step in and save her on that day? Why didn't she have the vaccination earlier? What sense was there in giving birth to this beautiful girl and then having her taken away from us? Why did it happen to us? As time passed, however, that anger subsided. We live in a fallen world, so the question wasn't really why us, but why not us? As Christians, we don't get a get out of jail free card when it comes to suffering. Just because we try and live our lives as best we can for God doesn't mean that the fallenness of this world won't touch us. We are not promised that. I don't know why God didn't step in and rescue Abby. We certainly prayed a lot for that to happen on that Saturday, but he said no. It will certainly be the first question I ask when I get to heaven. But I do know that God is sovereign. He knows way better than I do, that he loves me, that he wept with me, and that it's much better to live in that place of acceptance and trust than to live in that place of anger and rejection of him. Thanks, everyone. Back to you, Tobes.
Bless you, Emma. Bless you for sharing. Bless you for reliving that tragedy for us and helping us in our attempts to learn and understand. Our greatest fear when we're faced with someone who has experienced trauma, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. We can't solve it. We can't fix it. So we feel inept. So our strong temptation, rather than find ourselves in that situation, is to cross to the other side. But let's revisit some of Emma's words. In order to be brilliant, they didn't have to do anything. They encouraged me out of the house, gave me opportunities to talk. And she said the secret of being a good friend in that time was to be present in that moment of crisis and to be present afterwards. We didn't need someone to give us the intellectual reason why Abby had died. We just needed someone to be there to walk it through with us. Sadly for Job, his friends lost their empathy and in their hunger for what they saw as theological correctness. And that is the message for us today from this section of Job. Job just needed his friends to be present, to be there with him. A classic example of actions being more important than words. So, Christians, friends, have the love, have the courage to be present with someone when you come across them in their suffering. Have the agape love, the self-sacrificial love to be willing to walk alongside and suffer alongside. That is enough. Over to you, Ricky.